Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to start out by telling you a story, and the reason for this story is none other than that this is about the only audience that will appreciate it. My editor at my publisher, who happens to be an American, he phoned me up one day and he said, I always like to expand my stock of knowledge. He said, I feel I should know something about John Locke. I said, okay. He said, what should I read? And I said, well, you know, the sort of standard text that most people read when they want to get introduced to John Locke is his Second Treatise of Government. He said, okay. So he went out and got the Second Treatise of Government, and he used to take his brown bag lunch down to the local park and sit there in the park and read John Locke's Second Treatise. And one day, he was there reading, and this homeless man shuffled by. He said, what are you reading? And my editor said, John Locke's Second Treatise of Government. And this guy, the homeless man, a great Canadian, said, John Locke, the old fascist, he said, Hume's your man. We have a better class of homeless people in Canada. Lenore Ely was kind enough to ask me to come and talk about Friedrich Hayek's critique of social justice and its relevance to current political debates. And I'll try and touch on civil society, although that's not sort of the main focus of my talk. Tall order in 15 or maybe 20 minutes, even for an old Hayek hand like myself, but I think we can at least do something to get the conversation started. Here it is. Ignorance. Everything starts from ignorance. Ignorance is the basic human condition. And knowledge is the great disruptor of social relations, and especially of hierarchy and pattern, while also being the generator of progress of all kinds. If, therefore, we want progress, we must endure the constant upending of social relations. The Hayekian insight is that only a philosophy of justice that concerns itself solely with judging the rightness of or justice of actions, of individual actions, is compatible with this central mechanism of progress. Hayek's view is that if the individual actions we perform are each just individually, then the aggregate of these actions, in other words, the state of society, the distribution of desired things, is also by definition just. It does not need to be separately justified. Now, concepts of social justice that appeal instead to ideas of ideal outcomes, of patterns of distribution that are somehow aesthetically pleasing, must constantly seek to obstruct socially disruptive forces because they cause the pattern of distribution that they admire to be constantly overwritten with a new story. There is thus perfect harmony between progress and Hayek's procedural justice, and a constant tension between progress and social justice, to the extent that the latter rests on the premise that outcomes must be arranged in such a way that it is pleasing to our prejudices. Progress upends patterns, no matter how much we may cherish them, those patterns. But if the issue is that social justice disrupts progress, then surely the question must be, what is progress? And why should we prefer progress to the stately continuation of familiar and honored patterns of social life? And the answer, I believe, is that for Hayek, progress is all about beating back the frontiers of human ignorance, of extending the power of humanity to better its condition through the acquisition of new knowledge. And here is why that matters. Once upon a time, in ancient Greece, there was a ship transporting a cargo of something called natron, which is a washing powder, somewhere in the Mediterranean, doesn't really matter where. And they stopped to prepare a meal on a fine white sandy beach on an island in the eastern Mediterranean. Now, lacking stones on which to support their kettle, they used lumps of natron from the hold of the ship to hold their kettle over the fire, to suspend it. and the heat from the fire fused the natron in the sand. And it created something. Does anybody know what it created? Glass. Created glass. First time in recorded history that glass was observed. The nameless sailor who saw the shiny crust that had formed under the fire and whose mind rushed on to the possibilities implicit in this discovery had, by accident, discovered a single useful bit of information, one of what I like to call nature's slumbering secrets. By seizing it, by experimenting with it, and then exploiting it, he and those who came after him unknowingly unleashed a series of powerful transformations and innovations. It became possible to have both warmth and natural light in buildings. Pots could be glazed, the seeds of mason jars, petri dishes, and the great stained glass masterpieces of Chartres had been planted. Now, we want constantly to expand the areas in which we are not subject merely to mute and uncontrollable forces, but in which we control our actions and remake the world nearer to our heart's desire. When we are successful, we expand the realm of freedom not only for ourselves, but for all to whom we make our knowledge available. When we master nature's secrets, as the sailor on the beach did, we can put her forces in our service rather than be subject to them. We can build skyscrapers, travel to the moon, send information around the globe in the space of a heartbeat. And the more we know, the better we are able to outwit governments and other powerful agencies that we want that want us to live according to their priorities rather than our own. But this crucial information gathering and dissemination function requires the freedom of the individual for it to function. And yet the exercise of this freedom is highly disruptive of social relations, and especially of established order and hierarchy. New knowledge changes the distribution of power, it changes the distribution of income, it changes the distribution of work, and much, much more. As the new knowledge of Isambard Kingdom Brunel is displaced by that of Rockefeller, which is displaced by that of Edison, which is displaced by that of Bell and Packard and Gates and Walton and Jobs. Now, we as a culture pride ourselves on an impressive body of knowledge. And so emphasizing our ignorance, because that's really what I'm doing, I'm emphasizing the ignorance, not the knowledge of human beings. Emphasizing our ignorance does not sit well with many of us. Yet this may be precisely the overweening arrogance of the ignorant at work. While we pride ourselves on our knowledge of the physical world, for example, in fact, much of it is brought to us by people who happened by chance to witness some accident and understood at least a part of what they had seen. That Greek sailor who discovered glass is merely the earliest recorded example that I know of this principle at work. Many other discoveries that were the fruit of fortuity have changed the course of human life for the better. Aniline dyes, photography, x-rays, the discovery of the relationship between electricity and magnetism, the curing of rubber, the telephone, the phonograph, welding, steel making, the telescope, and penicillin. Anybody know the story of penicillin? Sir Alexander Fleming had a germ culture in a petri dish, and a bit of mold landed in the petri dish and ruined his experiment. He was about to wash it down the sink, and suddenly he observed that that mold was killing the bacteria that he was trying to culture, and that is the origin of penicillin. These are only a few choice examples. We knew nothing about the ability or the potential of the physical world to supply us with such wonders until somebody stumbled upon them and saw what they were. Now, we're not merely ignorant about the physical world. We're also ignorant about ourselves. Consider a man I know who makes Scottish Highland paraphernalia, sporrans, daggers, bagpipe fittings. I play the pipes. I won't play them for you now, but it's something I know a lot about. One day he was reading the newspaper. His eye fell on an ad from a company looking for people to submit tenders to make aircraft parts. And he, you know, sort of idly ran his eye over the advertisement, and he suddenly realized that with the equipment he had for making sporrans and daggers, he could make aircraft parts. And in that brief moment, his understanding of himself and of his capabilities was transformed. He now saw himself not only as a maker of daggers and sporrans, but as a maker of aircraft parts. And he now employs a number of people in that business, as well as carrying on his traditional activities. different kind of example of the ignorance that we're all subject to. Consider that by most estimates, the stock of knowledge in the world is exploding at an unprecedented rate. In cutting-edge fields such as computer science or nanotechnology, the total amount of knowledge in the world doubles roughly every 18 to 24 months, while the whole body of human knowledge doubles about every 15 years. One half of everything that is known today was not yet known in 1998, and one half of everything that's known today in, say, biotechnology was not known in 2011. Now, on the other hand, the capacity of the human mind to process information, what's called the channel capacity, is essentially unchanged since Homo sapiens emerged over 100,000 years ago. The channel capacity is estimated to be roughly four or five ideas. That's the number of ideas you can hold in your mind, juxtapose against each other, see how they connect and so on. That's on a good day. God knows what the channel capacity of the mind is on a Monday morning after spring break. What does this mean? What does this mean? Well, amongst other things, that we as individuals are condemned to ignorance. We are condemned to ignorance. Our brain's capacity is relatively fixed, while the knowledge known by all human beings collectively is expanding exponentially. It's expanding literally exponentially. With minds so limited and knowledge so vast and variegated and pullulating, you and I are condemned to see a narrowing slice of what is known, at the same time as humanity as a whole has never had more access to more knowledge. So far we've established, or at least I've established to my satisfaction, I don't know about anybody else, we don't know what we're doing. We don't know who we are. We don't know what we're capable of. We don't know what is happening to us, and we don't know what is to come. But there's more ignorance to catalog. We don't know, for example, what effects our own actions will have. Change, which at first looks destructive, often brings great and quite unexpected benefits later. No one can foresee all the consequences that their actions unleash. Consider in this regard something as simple as the invention of the motor car. No one foresaw the myriad social transformations that would be wrought by this invention as people began to see and exploit its potential. Certainly, the inventors of the motor car were no better at crystal ball gazing than anyone else. They believed that the total number of cars in the world would be forever limited by one factor, one insurmountable obstacle. Does anybody know what that obstacle was? The number of members of the working class intelligent enough to be trained as chauffeurs. And yet, the car was nearly to destroy, for example, the horse industry. Almost 20 million horses lived and worked in North America at the turn of the last century, creating work for blacksmiths, livery boys, makers of nails, harnesses, and saddles. Hay and oats were major cash crops, and of all this, nothing remains today. Local institutions like the rural school and church fell victim to the school bus and the Sunday drive. City centers shrank, suburbs blossomed, hemlines, drive-ins, and highways went up. Barns, travel times, and sexual mores came down. Millions of individual ideas, adjustments, desires, and innovations all conspired to work a transformation on the face of society, which even the most prescient could never have envisioned. Now, if authorities had had the power to stop such social transformations, to prevent the kind of experimentation I'm describing, some immediate suffering might well have been prevented and some established interests protected. But we would still be working the land, and few enough of us would have horses, let alone automobiles. Now, to return to the theme of my talk, I'm sure you're wondering what the heck this all has to do with social justice. To return to the theme of my talk, justice versus social justice, we can perhaps see a little more clearly what's at issue. If human progress depends on the discovery of new knowledge, and if new knowledge on balance improves the quality of human life, and if new knowledge is irremediably linked to the disruption of patterned social life, then a philosophy of social justice that prizes patterned distribution, say a limit on how much even the best paid can earn relative to the worst paid, or even some kind of that unworkable will-o'-the-wisp, the Rawlsian Maximin principle, will worsen the condition of humanity, will make us less able to solve our problems, will make us less able to pursue our purposes with success. But Hayek does not urge on us and indifference to the plight of the worse off. On the contrary, all he enjoins us to do is to pursue compassionate justice without worrying about the pattern of relations between the top and the bottom, or between, say, social classes or any other kinds of groups into which society can be divided. His philosophy of justice is not one of envy, not one of leveling down to an equally shared burden of ignorance and poverty. His suggestion is to establish a floor beneath which no one should be permitted to fall, going so far, as some of you may know, even as to suggest a guaranteed annual minimum income. Why? Because such a scheme, especially if it's financed by a just taxation system, and we could have an interesting conversation about that, such a scheme leaves untouched the creative destruction, the pattern-smashing upheavals occasioned by knowledge discovery. It says that the overarching pattern is too dynamic, too shifting, too positive in its long-term effects to be the proper object of our reforming zeal, but that the damage caused to those at the bottom by the full-throttle disruption, the full-throttle disruption of this process of creative destruction, may properly be the object of our concern and our care, even though no one may benefit more from new knowledge discovery than the poorest, as many of Sam Walton's customers can attest. And I will conclude by saying that is a concept of justice with a social conscience of which no one need feel ashamed. Thank you.